This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're exploring climate as a factor in mental health with Maya Rose Craig, a British Bangladeshi birder, environmentalist and diversity activist, who campaigns for equal access to nature and an end to the climate and biodiversity loss crises. And this was an interview I so enjoyed. We talked a lot about balancing the understandable concerns for the climate with how we still find ways to look after ourselves. And Maya Rose draws on her own experiences around mental health, both personally and within her family, in such an insightful way. And so I don't have a huge amount to say. I think the interview really speaks for itself. She was such a delight to talk to, and she has such a humour and light about her, and so much of the joy that she has being immersed in nature comes across so clearly. And it's really lovely to see, and particularly when you hear about how much of that is instilled from her family and how much joy they were able to find through nature and through bird watching together, even at times when those close to her were really struggling. And so that's what I'll say for now. I also do have a quick plug that doesn't relate to today's episode, but does to previous guest Fisky, a wonderfully talented friend of mine who has just released his new album called Cheaper Than Therapy. And I'll include a link for that in the episode description. And not only is it a really compelling listen that relates so much to his own experiences of mental health, it includes a lot of collaborators like Charles Edison, another previous guest on the show, and surprise, surprise, me. And indeed, this very podcast is sampled on the title track, Cheaper Than Therapy. So go check that out if you ever want to hear what I sound like over music. Now is your chance. It's such a privilege to be involved even lightly in this project. And as someone that loves music as much as I do, I'm so excited to continue consuming this, see whatever he comes up with next as well. And so with that mentioned, we'll get into the episode with Maya Rose Craig in a moment. I will also say, if you're considering joining our Apple Podcast subscription program that we've just updated on this podcast to include debrief chats after the conversation, this is one of the ones where it's so clear. You'll really get why I was so passionate about making this work. Because this is a great example of how reflecting on the conversation can, you know, nudge you a layer deeper and into some of the really important intersectionalities that can come up as it relates to mental health support, as it relates to, obviously, climate change as well. And so often my guests do reflect on the things that they share and how it is to talk about mental health publicly when we get out of the main interview segment. And it's certainly something that always fascinates me. And I think it's incredibly empowering to hear. You know, we can, even if we know better, get caught up in the idea that some people seem to have the answers and some people don't, and it can be that linear, and it's not, and we're all figuring it out. And so I really appreciate Maya being so open with that through the interview, but also particularly as we reflected on it. So with that said, we'll get into this interview in a moment. It's a good one. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hi, I'm Maya Rose Craig. And reflecting on early experiences with mental health, the thing that's most striking for me is the lack of understanding that I had when I was very young around it, partially because those conversations had just never had with me, because I'm talking like 7 years old. Like, I just didn't really understand, and I didn't have the language to talk about that sort of thing, which I think I became aware of probably a bit younger than a lot of people, because it turned out that my mum was actually severely mentally ill And there was a lot of stuff that had been going on for a few years that I just didn't really have the language to talk about and therefore understand, because she had very severe bipolar disorder. So she was swinging between these manic episodes where, you know, she was my mum. She was very lively and fun and we're doing loads of stuff and, you know, all that sort of thing, to like very severe depressive episodes. I don't think I knew the word depressed at the time. So it just went from like mum's happy to mum's really tired and lethargic and isn't talking to us and isn't interested. You know, it's like all this sort of thing. And I just didn't understand. And even when I was about 8 or 9 and she told me I probably have bipolar, like I remember I like Googled it and went on Wikipedia to see what it was. And I just didn't understand what it meant. And I think like in terms of the way that we talk to kids, especially about mental health and mental illness, like it's so strange. It's one of those things where it's like you can't tell kids about that sort of thing because it's a grown-up issue. And it's like, actually, that's not true. Like there are children who are dealing with family members who are really unwell. There are kids who themselves probably actually are quite severely unwell. And most people just don't have the tools to talk about it, understand it, observe it, any of that sort of thing.
For sure. And there's still a lot of this weird stigmatizing idea that if you talk to kids about it, somehow they'll catch it by hearing about it. And I think that really reflects how ill-prepared most adults feel to have certain conversations, to know what to do and to not panic when they're around young people that are struggling. Maybe it reminds them of the ways in which they've struggled and not known what to do either. And for yourself, being around your mum and these dramatic mood changes, was the part of it that in some ways became normalised, that you would observe her in quite different forms of being and that became like a part of how she was, that you didn't know any different? Or do you think you were always aware there was something?
I think especially because from a kid's perspective, these were mood swings that were like, it would be months that were one or the other. So it wasn't the sort of thing where like one day she was this and then the next day she was that. It was much more long-term than that, I suppose. And I remember she was sectioned when I was about 10, and afterwards it was basically very strongly encouraged that I had to go to like therapy and talk about it and, you know, do all the healthy things. But I remember I hated it so much because the question they'd always ask is like, how do you feel now that your mum's ill? And or something along those lines, how do you feel now that you know she has bipolar? And it just didn't mean anything to me as a kid because she was just mum. And for me, it was very sort of interlinked with who she was as a person and how I observed her, especially in terms of the more manic side of things. Like that was how I thought of her as a person, just very sort of passionate, outgoing, you know, all that sort of thing. And so them going like, how do you feel about this? Nothing had changed. Apart from that there was now a label attached, which, you know, because I was very young, that also didn't really mean anything to me. And I think, I don't know, it's more interesting looking back, I suppose now that, because she's on, you know, a lot of medication and things like that, and there are still some mood swings within that. It's not like, you know, turned into a vegetable or whatever, but like, I think it's really interesting looking back to that period when I was a kid, because from an adult perspective, there was a lot of stuff going on. And there were these really big mood swings, and it was actually probably really strange, but I just didn't notice any of that as a kid, which I do think, I don't know, I think it shows that unless someone like tells you the usual, you don't really clock it for the most part when you're little.
Yeah, well, a lot of judgmental attitudes are learnt. You know, they're not something that we innately have. And we will really take people at face value in a lot of ways as a young person. And it sounds like, you know, that's really what you did. And even as a kid as well, those manic episodes may have even been quite fun to be around. There might have been part of you that's like, oh no, but if you're saying that this is something happening for her that needs to be worked on, then who is she on the medication? Who is she when she's getting the support?
And I think it was really interesting because, like I said, I was about 10 when all of this happened. And so I spent a lot of my teen years were spent sort of figuring out who she was as a person beyond the bipolar. Because I think, I don't know, I think there's a habit of talking about mental illness as a separate entity from ourselves, you know, like a separate chunk of our brain that's off there doing something different. When it's not, it is woven into who we are as people. And so I think especially with something like bipolar, which is really severe, you know, it's totally woven into who she is as a person. And I just can't she just would be a completely different person if she hadn't had it in the first place. And so I think this sort of ties in with the wider narrative of, like, mental illness needs to be fixed, it needs to be cured, when a lot of the time that's legitimately just not an option. It's just sort of managing something that you are then dealing with. And so I think this is why these questions when I was a kid really upset me, because you couldn't really separate my mum and the bipolar, because they were one and the same. Yeah.
No, I know what you mean. And I think that is a really important distinction. This mentality of fixing, which can be very linear and perhaps is more informed by physical health in a lot of ways, with that historically being so much further ahead in terms of research and understanding, and still so today, versus managing. And yeah, definitely from my own experience, managing feels the accurate word. I would still describe myself as having the diagnoses that I've been given. Does that present very differently today? Yes. Do I cope very much differently today? Absolutely. But I think for me personally, whilst we all approach it differently, it feels like a more comfortable space to be like, these are what I deal with, and this is where I'm at with them. Whereas I think if I was like, okay, I need to get fixed, and then if I'm fixed and then I relapse, I have some bad days, the depression comes back, then is that then compromising who I am? You know, if you think about it as separate in that way. And so what were you able to understand, you know, as you got older, of how your mum understood her condition and how she interacted with the support?
I think it's interesting, actually, in the, like, obviously she's older than me, and I think older generations do have quite often a very different perspective when it comes to mental health. And so I think for a really long time, the goal was to get better, even if that wasn't, like, literally better. That was, like, to find the perfect cocktail of drugs, for example, that could help balance her out. And I think what I didn't realise when I was younger was that actually going on these wild swings is actually not super fun for the person experiencing either. So she wanted to sort of balance herself out. And I think with the end goal that eventually you would find this perfect combination of medication that would just work forever, and then you could take that, and then for the rest of the day you can pretend that nothing else is going on. And I think even though medication is incredibly important, I think the thing that she didn't realise is that it's not as linear, like you said, it's not as linear as that. It's not really a journey with a beginning and an end. It's just sort of an ongoing exploration, like even for the fact that medication has to be adjusted and the amount that you take has to be changed and things like that. Like, we're constantly adjusting things. There are still mood swings within this, things like that. But I think the thing that really cinched it, more for her than for me, was when I was writing my book, actually. Because, you know, it's this whole story of this family coping with mental illness as a unit and things like that. And then we went all the way through, and I got to the epilogue, and there was this sort of inclination to go, and they all lived happily ever after, and everything was better, the end. And it's just not true. And I think it's seeing it written out on paper like that, it became much more clear that this is ongoing, and that's not even in a bad way. That just is how it is. But yeah, in general, writing the book was a very weird process for all of us. Like, I spent a lot of time talking to my mum and my dad, actually, about a lot of the stuff that had happened when I was a kid. And I think it was very interesting because everyone had very different perspectives on this journey that we've all been on together.
Mm-hmm. No, I can imagine. And in terms of the impact of nature and specifically bird watching on yourself and your family, and the positive mental health impacts of that, did you find that a lot of that came quite organically? And then looking back and writing the book, you start to realise just how many ways there was positive impact there?
Yeah, for the first half of the book, it is very organic. And it was, we've always been very into birds and bird watching. We've always gone out. But in particular, it's been something that we've done as a family, as a group. And we very often, like, you know, we switch our phones off when we go out. We're just, like, with each other and in nature, which I think that disconnect is also really, really important. And so you have things like, I talk a bit about when I was 7, we went on this big year of bird watching. And that was definitely all about escapism and sort of my parents trying to look after their own mental well-being. Although in the end, it turns out that my mum was probably a bit manic during that period and she fell into a depressed episode at the end of the year. But the point still stands that my parents were trying to use bird watching and going outside as although subconsciously, as a tool to sort of make themselves feel better. And we went on a few holidays and things like that where we went out into nature. And but I think the moment that really cinched it for us was when my mum was sectioned. It was, you know, it was during the summer holidays, and my dad spent a lot of time taking me outdoors. Like, the point in his head was, you know, to distract me from everything that was going on. But actually, he realised that summer that it was really, really important for him to spend time outdoors. And so it was after that that him and my mum came together, and they decided to very proactively use bird watching and going outside to help, basically. Not in a sort of magical mystery cure for anything, but more to use it as a tool to, I suppose, look after our well-being a bit. And we went on this really long 6-month trip around South America, which obviously was, yeah, a massive privilege, but it was amazing in that my mum was really, really unwell, and she couldn't even birdwatch when we started going on the trip. I remember she didn't have the attention span for it. She literally couldn't spot the birds. And she was just really struggling, really angry, really upset. And by the end of this trip, she was brilliant and she was having an amazing time. And also, I had essentially found my mum again, because I just hadn't really had a strong relationship with her for a couple of years at that point. And so that was the moment where we realised that this helps and it does make a difference. And it's not just sort of this old wives' tale where it's like, oh, go outside for a bit and you'll feel better. It does genuinely make a difference. Yeah, and since then, we've been using it to the biggest capacity we can, really.
That's so lovely to hear. And do you know where your parents got this passion for birdwatching from?
My dad is the one who started it all, but no one's quite sure where it came from for him, because my grandparents they liked going on walks and things like that. But they weren't birdwatchers, but from a very young age, like 4 or so, he showed an interest in birds and the outdoors, and I think he got like a bird identification book for his like 5th or 6th birthday and things like that, you know. But my mum and my older sister were the opposite. They were like city girls. They probably never really spent time outdoors or in the countryside. And it was only when they got married that passion was shared amongst the family. But it's, again, one of those things where I think for a very long time they'd subconsciously been using that as a tool to sort of look after themselves. And my dad in particular, he starts sort of vibrating a bit if he isn't able to go outside at least once a day, which is partially why I'm such a big advocate for accessibility into the outdoors and the countryside and things like that. Because I think it's really tragic that access to nature and the outdoors has become a privilege in the UK. It's sort of seen as something that's reserved for, you know, very white middle-class people, basically. And I do think breaking down these barriers is essential in terms of, I don't know, having a positive impact on mental health.
For sure. And I don't think I'm alone in, when I imagine a bird watcher, it is an older white guy. And that's partly why I asked, for yourself coming from a British Bangladeshi background and you being interested in this so young. And you're so right that accessibility is so important, and also such a difficult conversation, because it's, you know, it's not as clear cut as saying this and therefore that, but there are so many ways in which, you know, in Britain in particular, like the class system, where you live, where you can afford to live, the extent to which nature can be kind of like boxed up and privatized, these factors can all play a part in making it, yes, genuinely very difficult to spend time in nature, more so for some people than others.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It was partially from my own experiences with the importance of access to nature and the outdoors that I started my charity, Black to Nature, which a lot of the work that we do is very grassroots, working with kids and teenagers from Black and Asian backgrounds and taking them out into the countryside and nature and sort of going, you know, this is a positive space that's good for you and it's good to spend your time. And, you know, obviously there's a very, very big issue with mental illness within Black and Asian minority ethnic communities in the UK. And so we spend a lot of time just having very gentle conversations with the kids, going, just saying things like, you know, if you're angry or upset or sad, just go and sit in the park by yourself, even for 10 or 15 minutes, and it will make a difference. And it's just quietly trying to give these kids the tools to manage their own mental well-being. Because I do think that's something that children are not taught and are not well versed at all, and then that's carried through into adulthood, and then you get loads of adults who aren't able to manage their own mental well-being.
I'm one of the examples of that, absolutely. I can relate to that a lot. And I think particularly for the generation coming up now, there is such a need for nature in people's lives, and I think a need for that to be conscious, because it is so easy to live so much of your life digitally now. There is less access to nature in many ways, and if we look at previous generation, there's less necessity to be in nature in many ways in your day-to-day life. And then that's coupled with the concerns for climate change and the way young people are so plugged into this. You know, we're so aware of the threat and how that is disproportionate the younger you are. And so for yourself, you know, what's your understanding been like there? And do you find that impacts you mental health wise, seeing firsthand the way the climate is changing and understanding that impact through your involvement with birds in a way that a lot of people don't have that direct access?
Yeah, I think the environmental crisis is having a massively, massively detrimental impact on an entire generation of young people's mental health. And, you know, you've got the studies to back that up, but you've got anecdotal experience to back it up as well. I think there was a study that came out a few months ago that said, like, 57% of Gen Z think that we're doomed and that there's no point trying. And it's like, how do you even live your life if you think that, you know, so you've got things like that going on. I know there was a young girl who's a daughter of a family friend who it was maybe 8 at the time or 9. And she was coming home and she was just having enormous panic attacks, massive sobbing fits, because she was so stressed and so overcome by the anxiety of climate change and environmental destruction. And I think it's this massive concept for what are often very young children to come to terms with. And then on the flip side of that, obviously, I've been really involved in climate change activism. And so I know a lot of very young people who have gotten involved in activism. And it's the same thing. You can see the massively detrimental impact it's having on people in so many different ways as well. You know, you have the whole point of people feel like they have to advocate for every single issue at once, especially people who are very online, sort of like you need to be talking about everything all the time or you're a bad activist, which obviously is literally impossible. You also have people who, you know, are so aware of the urgency of this issue, of the ginormity of this issue, that they feel like they have to give everything to the movement. Like, they feel like they can't stop, and they don't stop until suddenly you have loads and loads of people completely burning out, becoming very anxious, very depressed, and completely unable to do anything because they've just done too much too soon. And I'm talking about, like, 16, 17, 18 year old kids who are wiping themselves out. And I do think it links to this wider mentality of, like, oh, young people sort it out, which you do hear from so many older people. They're like, oh, you're what gives me hope, you're what makes me feel better about the future. And it's like, actually, I didn't want to spend my teen years campaigning and protesting. I would have loved to just been doing kid stuff. Like, it's not a good thing, and it's, like, incredibly disrespectful to frame this as a positive thing.
Yeah, that part right there. And I see that in particular so often towards Greta Thunberg, who I have so much respect for, but also, you know, I do worry for her in a way that so much of her life so far has been so defined by fighting for the planet in a way that you just don't see so many world leaders show up to anything the extent as this teenager. And, you know, the impact of not only, like you say, the burnout, but also I think that contrast can be incredibly dangerous. Like, it does seem to become something that might fit under the term of gaslighting at times, when you're living a life where you're so checked in to the impact on the planet, and yet, you know, the adults around you are focused on so many other pressing issues, and I can understand that, but it must be kind of mind-blowing to try and wrap your head around this is so urgent, and yet it is not being responded to with the urgency that would be appropriate.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's why, I don't know, I just know so many young people who are just, it's not even worried anymore, just really, really angry. And I've been thinking a lot about this last year or so. Like, I was born in 2002, yeah, like I'm 20. I'm just thinking, you know, there were 4 decades that they knew about climate change before I was even born. Like, this is an issue that could have been solved before I was born. Mm-hmm. And instead I've spent the last 9 years campaigning about it. And I think that is enough to really mess with someone. And so, yeah, but essentially you're getting to a point where a lot of climate activists are making themselves really ill, really unwell, and they feel like they can't stop.
I can totally see that. I mean, I remember when it was called global warming, and at the time there were a lot of people, and sadly still too many today, that are like, oh, but a few degrees, you know, that'll be great for me, you know. There's such narrow thought process on it of like, oh, I wouldn't mind if it's a few degrees warmer. And I miss the snow. I've seen even that in my lifetime, how rarely we even see snow in the winter in this part of the world now. It is really tough. And, you know, that is a growing form of anxiety, is eco-anxiety. It's not a separate diagnosis currently, but I really would suspect in the next few years it will be, because how common it is and how difficult it is to treat in many ways, because, you know, there are a lot of ways in which anxiety can be the problem. The anxiety becomes a problem bigger than the concern. And yet it's difficult to even know if this 100% does fall under anxiety, because the concern is so understandable and real. And there isn't, we can't say it's a disproportionate fear.
It's really interesting, actually, because I was talking to someone recently about why eco-anxiety hasn't been made into, you know, a diagnosis, things that they are saying, you have eco-anxiety. And they were saying it's because of what you were saying, that anxiety is supposed to be, if not irrational, then sort of overly extreme and things like that. And they feel like they can't appropriately say that eco-anxiety is that sort of response, because these issues are so real. You know, in some ways it's an entirely reasonable response to climate change and environmental destruction and the state of the planet, but it is sort of like, at the same time, even though conceptually that is, you know, a really important line of thinking, at the same time kids are really struggling, and it's like, how do we give them the support that they need?
Yeah, and particularly when that fear is so much attached to not enough is being done. That is absolutely legitimate. And you've had the opportunity, for example, of speaking at COP26 and seeing the spectacle that that was, in a way that, I don't know how you feel, but in some ways seemed to outstrip what actually came out of it.
Yeah. COP26 was, I'll not lie, for me, it was a really unpleasant experience. And I think it was for a lot of other activists as well, for various reasons. I think partially just because the event was really, really disappointing. I think a lot of activists felt incredibly let down. It was, in some ways, a complete farce of negotiation. And there was this very, very strange contrast between inside and outside the conference, where inside it was sort of very passionless and non-urgent and very passive. And outside you had thousands and thousands of people protesting who were angry and passionate and wanted change. And it highlighted to me more than ever how little we're getting from our leaders. But also on a personal level, like, mentally it was really, really difficult. And I genuinely, I haven't actually said this before, but I like spent the whole like time I was there, I was just crying all the time, because I was so stressed. Like, I was just so like stressed about everything that was going on. And I like left on the last Sunday, I think, and I was just exhausted, like emotionally, mentally exhausted. And I just didn't do anything for like weeks. And I think for me, that like epitomized like the whole climate anxiety thing, where it was like a very visceral emotional response to the way that climate change is being handled, basically. But it was really difficult.
Yeah, and it must feel quite inescapable in many ways, because you can go home, but the news of it follows you. Climate change continues, and you wonder, okay, what is next? So much was put on that conference as a big hope, And I don't know, I'm yet to meet anyone that felt satisfied.
I don't think there is anyone that's like, it was not successful. And I think, I won't even get into all of that, but it was just awful. And I went back to uni and I just wanted to like curl up the ball. Like, I just didn't look at the news for a few days, which I felt incredibly guilty about, but I just couldn't. Yeah.
That's also really interesting to me because I had that particularly with the pandemic, where I felt such an obligation to really follow the news. And, you know, it was having an impact on our day-to-day lives in a way that, you know, it never had before in my lifetime. That restrictions could be announced one day and the next day what we're allowed to do with our day can totally change. And it is incredibly stressful and you do want to turn away and yet you can feel like you can't. And so how do you find that balance for you with your activism and how much you do consume?
I'm not lying. I don't think I have any like healthy advice on this one. Like, I think it must be a very strange experience following me on social media because I sort of swing wild. You can tell how I'm doing in terms of swinging wildly between like posting all the time and being really passionate and really angry to like radio silence where I just can't bear to go online.
Fair, yeah.
So I think it basically gets to that point where I've just been doom scrolling too much and I just leave, and it's, I have such a love-hate relationship with like social media where it's one of those things where I strongly suspect I would be much happier if I sort of deleted it all and went to go live in the woods, but at the same time that's not an option on a practical level, but also in terms of, well, I guess this is what we're going back to, like this climate anxiety, feeling of responsibility, like you can't just stop, like you just can't. So
yes, and yet I do think there's an important start there in what you mentioned of sometimes you do need to take a step back from it, you know, that you're not going to forget how important this is because you're not consuming new news articles for a day. And I think sometimes we have to give ourselves, you know, that grace. And this is part of the broader problem that no one person can solve it. And at times in our digital age, it can feel like that's the expectation, that you've got to have the right answer for any person's ignorance or explaining away just how important this is. And if you don't, then you're failing or you're letting down the cause. And in fact, you know, the people that are letting down all of us are those that, you know, are questioning this and questioning you versus going and reading and learning for themselves. That's what I would say.
I think that's something that most of us know as well, deep down, but it's so difficult practicing your own good advice in day-to-day life.
Oh, yes.
Which I guess is what a lot of this boils down to.
I try and be very honest with my platform that I have a lot of the right thoughts. Whether I consistently follow them is a very different story.
Yeah, but it is so difficult to do the right thing. And I think that's, again, what...
Well, it's really difficult to do the right thing by yourself in a lot of ways. Like, I feel like that's the bit we're never taught. We're taught about, you know, respecting thy neighbour or however it is that's taught to you. And, you know, our family and our friends and our peers and our teachers. And that's still something missing as you grow up, is where we respect and look after ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. But I suppose that's a wider issue within the culture where it's like you're supposed to put yourself last in a lot of ways. I think especially in terms of, you know, this like grind culture where it's like you need to be doing something all the time and you need to be working and you need to be, I don't know, making the world a better place, etc., etc. And it's like on the list of priorities, you're supposed to be right at the bottom, really, even though no one ever says that explicitly.
Yeah. Or maybe they say it in terms of thinking that certain people are selfish, you know, and it is that extreme that you're expected to maximize every hour. And yeah, our digital lives can kind of contribute to that, where you're like, okay, I've got a few spare seconds, I best tweet something. Yeah. And you know, I try and stay off social media in a lot of ways because, you know, I do notice the impact on my mental health and I try and be mindful of that. Is that something that you've had to work on?
Something in the process of being worked on, maybe. Yeah, I think I am slowly trying to make my relationship with the internet more positive. Like, it definitely has become more so, because when I was younger, there was a lot of, like, online abuse and things like that, like where it was like a very just unpleasant place to be for me, more so in terms of my race activism than my climate change stuff. But yeah, there was lots of stuff, which interestingly peaked in like 2016, 2017, just around like Brexit Trump era, which yeah, I think there's probably something to unpack there. But yeah, so I think, you know, the internet has become a more positive space for me. And like definitely during that period, I wanted to like delete it all and stop forever. And I am glad I didn't, but I'm slowly working on it, like we all are, I suppose. It's sort of this, like, well, it's like we were saying earlier, it's sort of this continuous journey of trying to make things a bit easier for ourselves, a bit better.
Yeah, and I think a big key of that is trying to be okay with ourselves along the way. I think whilst you're very honest about not having all the answers and still working on finding your own boundaries, it's also good to see that you can sort of like have a laugh about it and be compassionate about yourself in that, okay, I don't have all the answers yet, but I'm not failing because I don't.
Yeah, I think as well, like one of the really interesting things, I think partially actually from my relationship with my mum's mental illness. And so my first experience with mental illness not being anything to do with me in particular, like I think that external perspective has made me a bit kinder in terms of my own mental health and my mental well-being, and like being a bit gentle on myself. And it's sort of like, if I am like a bit depressed or whatever, like it's okay, and we work on it and we like do the things to make it a bit better. Versus I feel like if no one's ever explicitly had those sort of conversations and then become unwell in some shape or form, like I think it is very difficult to be kind to yourself. So
Yeah, absolutely. In many ways, you got the practice showing that kindness to somebody else, which can so often be the easier way to learn it.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and definitely relate to that. And that's actually a nice note to wrap up on. So if people want to learn more about your work, your family's story and your activism, you have a book that comes out actually on the day that this episode goes live.
Cool.
Yeah, called Bird Girl. Do you want to share a bit about where people can find that?
I do, yeah. You can find the link for Bird Girl on all my social medias, which is, I'm just Bird Girl UK online. I like to be consistent. And you can also find Bird Girl in all the normal internet places where you buy books, you know, Amazon, Waterstones, things like that. And yeah, it's a book about, you know, my family's journey in terms of my mum's mental illness and things like that, like nature, birds, you know, love of birds, things like that, and also discussing my activism.
No, I love that. And I think it can be a difficult balance, as we touched upon, but there's definitely inspiration in it and in your work, that as much as we're not going to put the entire climate crisis on you to solve, it is reassuring to know that there are incredible advocates out there. And so I really appreciate talking to you today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And we'll be back for our Apple Podcast subscribers in a moment. I want to ask you a bit more about identity as a factor in this work. But for now, thank you. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.